Hi everyone, my name is Josh Extra Barbecue Hafkin, and this is Understanding Esports with Game Gym. The goal of our podcast is to help make esports and gaming more relatable by telling the stories of the people who work and play in the industry. Everyone who ends up in esports has a winding journey, and there is no typical path. I'll be asking our guests how they got their starts, what moments impacted them along the way, and the advice that they have for gamers, entrepreneurs, parents, and those looking to learn more about the industry. So don't worry if you aren't an esports person. I'm here to help you understand what's going on. You can learn more about Game Gym and our mission at www.gamegym.com, and you can let me know your thoughts on our discussion on Twitter at Extra Barbecue. So let's get into it. This is Understanding Esports. Hey everyone, just wanted to jump in and let you know that Game Gym's Spring Summit Championships are coming up April 2nd and 3rd. The Spring Summit will feature championships of our Mid-Atlantic Esports Conference, guest speakers, and giveaways all weekend. This month and up through the summit, we will be raising money for games-based research at Children's National Hospital. For more info on the Spring Summit or to donate, go to www.gamegym.com and check out our Spring Summit 2022 page. We'll also add the info to the show notes. Today, we are joined by Scott the Tantalus Robertson, Smash legend, event director, Twitch streamer, and father of three. So let's get into it. Scott, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Josh. It's good to catch up with you. It's been a while.
I know, man. I was looking forward to it. I feel like I always, you know, get a quick moment of view at events where we could catch up, but this will be cool, you know, deep dive into some things. You know, when I saw you at SmashCon over the summer, we talked about doing this. So it's pretty cool to be able to finally get it done.
Yeah, it's good to sit down. And even though SmashCon was actually in the fall, it was so warm that it felt like the summer. That's crazy. Because it was like 85 degrees in October. It's really weird.
Yeah, it was. It was that. You're right. It was the Fall Fest. But yeah, man. So, you know, just to start it off, you know, what have you been up to these days? What are you excited about? What are you working on currently that's got you jazzed?
So I've been real busy being a dad. I'll say that. You know, having three kids is it keeps anyone busy. But there's plenty going on here at home. The thing I was learning recently was how to edit videos. I've always wanted to get a Mario Kart highlight reel, and I never could find anyone who would do it for me. So I just did it myself, which is pretty much just fits my mold, I guess. So I learned how to edit videos in a week, and I'd never done it before. Actually, the software's fairly intuitive, but I'm always working on something. I've got some ideas in my head that I'm working, so I'll save those for when I'm ready. But that is what the big thing that I've been learning how to do lately.
That's awesome. It's always good to learn those new skills, and especially when you're like looking around for something and you're like, why doesn't this exist yet? And then you're like, well, I guess I'm gonna have to do it. And it's awesome too. I believe they just added 48 new tracks to Mario Kart, so you should be getting plenty of new highlights here soon.
Well, yeah, they're adding them in waves, so they will release the first wave of 8, so it's going to be 48 when it's all done, but for now, there's only 8 more, but there should be plenty. I've already grabbed a few, so I'll have to make another highlight collection after they're all been released.
Oh, yeah. I'm excited. My buddies and I, we hop on and play every once in a while, and we were pretty jazzed to hear about those new courses, and I feel like also being a Mario Kart level designer has probably got to be one of the coolest jobs in the whole world.
I would say so. There's so many things you can do with the stages and how you put them together and what kind of shortcuts you make. And I feel like, at least with Mario Kart 8, a lot of the shortcuts they made were unintentionally good. Like, it was sort of like the wave dashing and melee unintentionally good. So Mario Kart 8 is a really well polished game. I I want Mario Kart 9, but I'll never not be happy with Mario Kart 8.
Yeah, I can.
That makes sense.
Totally. All right, so you know, just to help people, you know, learn a little bit about you and you know your background, I'd love to kind of go back in time a little bit and talk about, you know, your upbringing and kind of Smash and you know how this all came to be. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, how video games were in your early life and, you know, what kind of relationship that did you have with them kind of during that middle school, high school time?
Sure. So video games have always been a part of my life. Ever as long as I can consciously remember existing, they've been there. My parents had me right in the same era of the NES getting popular, and they had an NES as far as I can remember. So I've always been playing games, and I always took right to it. Something that I've always loved. And as I got older and I played more and more, and you know, we didn't have money for a lot of games then, so we just played the same ones over and over. Middle school was right around when Smash 64 came out, actually. So I loved the Nintendo 64, always had Nintendo consoles, never had a Sega. If I wanted to play Sega or PlayStation, I had to go to a friend's house. And I was always behind everybody else. Never had what everyone else had first, so I was always, you know, trying to play catch up. I got a Super Nintendo Christmas of 94, for example. That console had been out for 3 years, so I was always behind, but I always felt like I was playing catch up. But eventually got Nintendo 64 and Super Smash Brothers, and that was kind of my thing. It was always my thing. It was just playing video games was my greatest hobby. And be it Perfect Dark or be it GoldenEye or any of the Mario parties, Mario Sports games, Super Smash Brothers. We would always get friends together, play together, play with my siblings. It's something that has lived with me pretty much since I was a little baby.
That's awesome. I mean, I feel like that's kind of, it's a very similar story that a lot of people have. They didn't necessarily have the console. You go over to your friend's place, play, and then eventually you get your own, and it's like the greatest day ever. So, you know, was it as you started to kind of get more involved, was it Smash that stood out? Were there other games at first that kind of like, you know, kind of took your attention? Or was it always kind of like Smash from the start, and how did that work?
Bridging out into the larger gaming world was always Smash. I was once a remarkable Halo 2 player and then moved into Smash or something like that. That's never really been the case. I've been good at a lot of games. I've never been really competed at a high tournament level at other games outside of Smash. I would say Smash didn't even stand out until Melee. Smash 64 was just another game we played. But Melee came out, I think it was a lot different. Melee was a much more comprehensive game and had a much higher skill ceiling than Smash 64. At least, we felt that way at the time. I'm sure people would argue now that Smash 64's skill ceiling is a little bit different, but at the time, Melee felt like it had, you know, so much precision and so many more things and mobility options you could do, so many more levels, characters, it just felt like you could never not master the game. Like there was always something left to be driven from in the game. Like you never could get the best at everything. There would never be a skill cap. And well, as kids, we thought that, and it turns out we were right, because that game is still going on very strong to this day, and people are still playing out of their minds things we've never seen before. So that's really what. Although I didn't break into the Smash scene in Melee, I think that's where the passion of Smash Brothers really stood out from the rest of the games that I play.
Yeah, I think that you're spot on there, and you know, the creativity and the amazing parts of Melee when, you know, people were doing stuff and people would say there's no way that you could do that all the time or every, you know, incorporate that into your everyday gameplay, and now these elements of things that people thought, you know, couldn't be done or would be done sporadically are now part of everyday life. It's amazing the evolution that a game and the player you know, fan base goes through when you're able to play a game like that for so long.
Yeah, it is crazy to see and to think about where we thought we were, you know, as a close group of friends, thinking, how could there be someone better than us? And we always thought that. And if you're listening to this podcast and you played Melee during its prime, before Brawl was released, I would say I guess it's not its prime, but yeah, you get what I'm saying. Like when it was the feature game and the only feature Smash game, and you probably understand what I mean by that. So it's just unbelievable. Everybody thought they were the best, and then you get into this larger world, and as soon as video sharing became a thing, because when Melee came out, it really wasn't a thing. And you realize you see a combo video made in Windows Movie Maker, and you're just like, oh God, these people are amazing. So, and even like DC++, is it DC++? I can't remember. There was a video sharing software before YouTube that people used to use to share combo videos. And that was like, the first time you see a Melee combo video, you're just like, oh my God, like you could do that? It's just amazing how far that game has gone from where we felt we were back then.
It really is. So can you talk to us about those early days? Like, you know, who was around? Who were you doing things with? You were starting to maybe organize tournaments. You were starting to, you know, kind of create these rule sets around things. And, you know, one of the things that I've always done, and since I've been in the scene, you know, I look at, you know, who's making rule sets and who's, you know, the people that we look to, you know, validate, you know, these, you know, different things. And I always saw, you know, the rule sets that came out of VGBC or that you designed were, you know, essentially a lot of industry standard stuff. So how did that kind of come to be? And can you talk to us about those early days of trying to, you know, add some more structure to this world?
Yeah, so I guess my tournament scene started in 2008, when Brawl came out. I didn't, other than local church tournaments, I never played in a real Melee tournament. And I could beat just about everybody there, right? So I don't really consider that my tournament days. But when Brawl came out, I thought I was really good at it. Here, I wasn't. There were plenty of people who were, and I was learning from them. The first person to really reach out and was Jay Caesar, and he was actually kind of a TO as well. And I learned a lot from him, both as a player and as a competitor, and ultimately started going to tournaments near me. And then one day there was a tournament near me and the TOs didn't show up. So the hosts were like, can somebody do this? Because we don't know how to do it. And I was just like, how hard could it be? And I seeded and ran my first tournament that day. And everybody's like, you're pretty good at this. And I was like, am I? So that's pretty much how it worked out. And then I got hired for another tournament. And they were like some other, you know, it was a store in a mall that hired me, but that was the first time that I actually got to help influence the rule set and select a stage list and that sort of thing. And I'm always for more stages. I've always been that way. My original ultimate stage list was criticized heavily, so I still would like to bring WarioWare back, but everyone.
Wow, that little small guy.
Uh-huh, yeah, I love WarioWare. I think ban it every time, fine. I like WarioWare, but nonetheless. So that was my first tournament where I influenced rules was 2009. And then my first major tournament was running Brawl Till You Fall for VG Bootcamp. I ran that in tandem with them. I wasn't the sole organizer. Gimmer did a lot of the work for that event, if I recall correctly. It's in a karate dojo. It's a two-day tournament.
Oh, that's dope.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. So, so that goes way back, to that era, of things, and that's where I really just started picking up more steam, and I just started getting myself involved in, any event I could make and anything I could put together. So,
That's awesome. So I guess, you know, here we have, you know, these first days of Smash, these first tournaments, and you know, Gimmer's around, some of these other guys are around. What was it like during that time? Did you realize that, it, you know, this was growing into something that was going to be big? Could you tell? Or was it just, you know, group of people getting together to play video games with their friends with, you know, very little, you know, future ambitions behind that? What was the kind of scene in feeling in that time?
So back then, like, the tournaments were, the biggest tournament you'd get is like 80 people. If you got 80 people, that was like a super major back then. It didn't feel like we were, it felt like we hit our peak early and then we're just trying to, you know, get back to where we were. It never really felt at that time, you know, the late 2000s, early 2010s, that Smash was going to explode or you know, grow exponentially. It was more of a, this is a really cool hobby that we like to do for fun, and this is the best way to keep it going is to keep running tournaments for people, keep trying new things. And in fact, I would say that even inspired us to be better at what we did, because if you weren't getting good traction with an event or getting good results, you might throw something at the wall until something sticks. So it gave us more liberty to be creative with event typings or low tiers, or just try and make things more fun for the attendees and make it more of a general experience, which actually I think did prepare us well for when Smash did explode, you know, when at the apex of YouTube and Twitch viewership.
Well, that actually brings me to that next point, which is, you know, I think a really cool, you know, there's always a series of things that allow things for it to explode. And it's usually, you know, a new game or a new something, a new patch, a new character, along with, you know, what is this, you know, social thing that's going on? So YouTube or, you know, TikTok or whatever, you know, what was it that really helped Smash explode? And can you talk about anybody, like, is there any specific moments that you were like, wow, like, this is huge and way bigger than I ever thought it could be getting?
Yes, I can distinctly remember the moment that I thought it, that I remember exploding, was when we had a Project M weekly that had like 50 people, and the weeklies had been 10 to 15 people until that point. And Project M had a stable build. I don't know if it was Project M 3. I think it was Project M 3, and it was really easy to set up and install, really accessible. So everybody knew how to do it really easily. You didn't have to hack your Wii to do it. It was just, you could open the snapshot menu, the SD card, and it would load the injection right in there, and then boom, you've got Project M. And I remember a Xanadu that previously every, you know, you had 15 people for all three games, and we had just 50 for one of them. And you know, Jay Caesar was really a pioneer of that. He was really promoting it, working really hard to promote it and network it, and he actually did almost too good of a job. So, I remember that Xanadu and the Xanadu venue being so crowded, and I was just like, how are we supposed to run? It's even in that moment, I was like, how are we supposed to run a 50-person weekly on a Tuesday night? It's impossible. But yeah, they do that all the time. So
that's amazing. Yeah, it's
that,
so crazy.
That was when I remember exploding. And like 5,000 people were watching on Twitch, I think, because that was when VG was starting to get their huge lift on Twitch. And I think those two things worked in parallel. The rise of Project M, the rise of VG Bootcamp. Those two things happened at the same time. No, we're not supposed to talk about Project M, but it's important. I'm not going to exclude it from the history.
No, definitely not. This podcast is not sponsored by Nintendo. We can talk about anything we want. it's super cool. And you know, I think back to those times, and you know, it must feel, you know, thinking back on it, kind of very innocent. Now, it feels so much bigger, and also yet, you know, still so much potential in where Smash could go, and can grow to. So, you know, what do you think has helped? You talked a little bit about YouTube and that rise. Can you talk about like how the ability to share clips, the ability to have VGBC as a massive entity in the space, How did that help push things along and maybe unify things across the country?
Well, at the time, that was the only real like Smash Weekly. So that is what sort of unified VD Bootcamp's presence in that moment. It's because there weren't any other facilities like that. There was nobody running a tournament in the middle of the week. That just didn't happen. They were the first to do that. And because the tournament, they used to do it themselves, like Gamer and Apostle would do the tournaments. But because the tournaments got so big, and I was there every week because I just love playing and love being there. And they got so big, they were like, can you help us with this? And that's, you know, I was already helping them with tournaments from here or there, but it got too big for them to manage it consistently. And we were still running Raw, Product M, and Melee all at the same time. It was, you know, it would get out of control really fast. So that made it really easy to centralize it and put it together. As far as the explosion of, you know, what took it, it's definitely like the Twitch. But Twitch kind of also got a rise at the same time. I can't remember when they were bought by Amazon. I want to say it was 16 or 17, but Twitch rising at the same time. Now they're the number one video streaming service in the world. So, or live streaming service. Sorry, live content streaming service. I think all of those things happening at the same time was really a boon, because that just, they're all brand new, right? They're all things that never really been experienced before. Or, you know, having a tournament with overlays. Especially at the weekly level, that was brand new. Normally, a tournament, if you had a tournament live stream back then, it was on Ustream or it was on Justin TV, or there's some other services that people used. But for the most part, they were just you could hear the commentators sometimes if they had commentators. I know MLG is famous for having the wife and husband commentary duo, but mm-hmm. It's pretty much just full screen gameplay. That was pretty much what you got. Is you got full screen gameplay, and sometimes you'd hear commentators on it. So just them putting effort into production was a big deal, because that's, until then, like I said, you never really had that on video games, unless you were MLG or unless you were a sports broadcast, right? So football game or baseball game or something. That the now it's standard for everybody to do it, right? It's become more accessible. But back then, I think the production value combined with the rise of Twitch, rise of YouTube, from a Smash perspective, VD Bootcamp being this kind of the centralized point of Smash content, that I think all of those things worked together very well. And that was a big piece of Smash getting huge quickly.
You got to have the right thing at the right moment with the right people. And it sounds like Smash was perfectly poised to, you know, be on this this upward trajectory. So, you know, as somebody who's been there from, you know, the beginning to now, you know, what would you say are some of the major, you know, major differences that, you know, either players or people have to, you know, deal with or experience? Or what are some of the major differences between Smash today with Ultimate versus Smash, maybe Brawl or in those early Melee days?
So with Brawl, like I said, it was like full screen commentary or full screen gameplay commentary. Maybe the first Apex was in 2009. That the Apex series, tournament series, which went on for, you know, 6 years or 7 years there. It's coming back this year, I think, maybe Boot Camp. So that first event, I streamed it. I don't know.
Oh, wow.
That's a weird fact that I have. I streamed it. I happened to bring my computer because I was like, hey, I'll help stream this. I have a Justin TV account, which became Twitch.tv, actually. So I ended up being accidentally ahead of the game. That's the one time I was accidentally in the fast lane. So brought this $10 mic that I plugged into my laptop. And a Dazzle. You guys know what a Dazzle is. And
I have no idea what a Dazzle is. What's a Dazzle?
It's a really, really old video capture encoder.
Oh, cool.
I still have it, actually. It's this big red. It looked like a, you know, like a Crayola toy. That's how I describe it. And it all it could do was input red, yellow, white, you know, a composite video and audio signal into a USB adapter, basically. So you had to do all the splitting yourself, and it was nothing like the capture devices we use today to do broadcasting and capture footage and that kind of thing. But we streamed on that, and that was like just having you. If you go listen to any of the, you look up Mutant King versus Ally in the finals there, just there's a bunch of people screaming in the background. That was the commentary back then. It's a lot more professional now. It's a lot more put together. They're kind of like big jumps. Like Evo 2013 was a huge jump because that was when we had the donation drive to get Melee into Evo, and then Melee made it to Evo and had the big finals and had a thrilling top eight with Wobbles, and it was very compelling, and it really like set the stage forward and leaped the production to the next level. And then like because Evo set a standard, everybody tried to catch up with Evo's standard. So I would say like that was what drove it, was making it there. And then like today in an Ultimate tournament, Devin 3000, House 3000, those guys have a great layout and preparation plan. That the streams you get from them, they do almost all the VG Bootcamp major events. There's a lot of people who help with that. I know Gen Games out there, MPT, they're all putting together replay booths on a tablet that the commentators can control and draw on, and all of that stuff. We had nothing like that back then. Sometimes you had to commentate the match, you had to look at the TV screen that the players were playing on, because you didn't have a split on your side. You couldn't even see the game on a monitor. You'd be lucky if you had a projector, right? And major tournaments back then, it was the same problem for the crowd. So you'd want the finals to be on some giant 27-inch CRT because, and yes, we had these CRTs for Brawl, so that the crowd could gather around and see it. And you'd have to, like, just, you know, I'm tall, so it was no problem for me to see over everybody. But if somebody was 5'5", they couldn't see the finals. So you just get mounds of people gathered around a TV. Actually, in some ways, I sort of miss that because the crowd gets... they're really up on top of those guys. So, you know, the players don't like that because it's a lot of noise in their ears and a lot of things, but it was a lot of energy too. It was a lot of hype, a lot of, you know, carrying on, usually positively. Like, you know, there's always the discussion on how much trash talk is too far, where's the line. You know, that energy is, FGC still has a lot of that today. I don't feel like Smash has as much of that anymore. We're a little bit more respectful. And people still argue where that line is, but that energy is, you won't get to see that anymore, but it is distinct and unique. And that was something that was, you know, largely different back then, of just, you know, to be able to see the finals, you had to be either really tall or get up really close. And that's what created some of those crazy clustered environments.
Yeah, it's the grassrootsness of Smash that makes it just feel that, you know, you're a part of the community, because you're literally like breathing on somebody's neck as you're pushing on your tippy toes to get a better view. Like you're in the community. Like that's such a cool vibe.
I remember staying if I wasn't at an event, I'd like stay on the Smashboards thread for the event, because there was no Twitter might have existed, but we didn't use it. So it was like, all right, what's going on in this tournament thread? Like somebody would post an update. Maybe a third of the tournament had a phone that could even post on the internet. So it's like somebody's going to post an update, or somebody's going to have a computer on the internet there. They can tell us what's going on. And then somebody would post an upset like, oh man, J-Man beat Jash. And I was like, what? What do you mean J-Man beat Jash? Like, you know, something like that. It's like, that was all we had to figure out what was going on there. If there was no live stream, you just had to keep your eyes on like a forum thread.
it's so true. And, you know, it's one of the amazing things about the Smash community, because there's all of these things that people were like, oh, we don't have this. And then they created it, or they took the initiative to take it to that next step, make the event, create the rule set, do all these things. And I think it's why Smash is so special and so unique. And there's so much community involvement and ownership and all of these wonderful things. You know, we can always, you know, there's always negatives to that as well. But, you know, one of the things that I've been amazed at is the Smash scene's creativity when it comes to solving problems. How can we do this? How can we create a ranking system? How can we get our clips out there? All of these different things. It's one of the most creative groups of people I've ever encountered.
Yeah, they really have done really amazing work. Just as I'm going to associate a lot of groups and names to things. VG Bootcamp, obviously, Panda. Those are definitely big players in the space, the PG Stats. And now, like I was just talking about the Smashboard forum to find out an upset. Now there's a dedicated Twitter thread that's robotic that they program the upset. So if there's an upset, it's just automatically Twitter posted. And it's just like, that is incredibly good work. That is completely unique to us. That, you know, they've developed that technology and other people could use it. Other people could apply it, but it was created because Smash had a demand for it because people wanted to know what was going on or what the upsets were without having to watch, you know, back watch three streams of footage to find the match that you're looking for, before it gets uploaded to YouTube, that kind of thing. So, we have been, I mean, let's look at Apex 2015. That was a chaotic tournament where the whole venue got shut down and we redesigned the whole tournament to run in 2 days. So it was
pretty amazing. I'm sure those people had heart attacks, but yeah, it was pretty amazing too.
Yeah, that's when the world found out how amazing Nintendo was, and what a godlike TO he was, the best in the world for sure.
The Smash scene is so special, and I think that, you know, anybody, you know, every community has special people, special, you know, aspects to it, but Smash to me seems pretty unique in that sense. But I want to shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about being a parent. I know that you have three kids, and, you know, Game Gym and what we do is all about, you know, trying to create a more healthy environment for kids and parents. So can you talk a little bit about maybe how did your parents treat video games? Were they positive? Were they negative? And then we'll kind of talk about how you're approaching these things with your kids.
Yeah, so my parents are pretty nonchalant about games. I mentioned that they're the ones that had the Nintendo in the first place, but it was more of a like, hey, let's just try this thing out, you know, here or there. It wasn't like meant to be like their primary hobby, whereas for me, it always was. And my parents always said they thought I'd grow out of video games. They thought that one day I would just not be interested in it anymore. It would just be like a fad, but that didn't work out, so... but they never really shunned it or were against it either. My dad was an athlete, so he was, you know, I don't want to say disappointed, but I think he had hopes that some of his children would be athletes like he was, and he had his chances. He was a tremendous athlete, but he had an injury that prevented him from pursuing it further. And so, you know, I think he had a hope in his mind that perhaps somebody would. But at the end of the day, I think parents just want their kids to be successful, whatever they do. And that's definitely where my parents were with me. You know, I never stopped pursuing a, I guess, traditional career while I've been playing video games. So, but they were pretty hands-off when it comes to the video game aspect. They really didn't, you know, one way or the other. In fact, they wouldn't even really buy us game consoles after a certain point. We kind of were just, you know, left to save money for ourselves and buy it up. That's how I got Nintendo 64. And I saved up my money. I bought it. I bought the games I wanted. And that's, you know, it was up to me to maintain it. And that's when my game collecting started, was because I bought the games myself. So they meant a little bit more to me.
Oh, that makes sense. It's definitely, I feel like, you know, we grew up around the same time. It was a time where, you know, video games were not taken seriously as a career. And I would say only in the last 10 years is it even more so. It's still not taken, you know, as seriously, but more so now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's really interesting to see how, you know, it never was an option. So I think parents then didn't really have to worry about it as much as now, like you actually can become a YouTuber. So, you know, what is it like navigating with your kids? How old are they? Do they play games? And how do you talk to them about video games?
So my kids, they like video games. My youngest isn't huge into it, but the other two like it. They're 6, 5, and 4. So they're prime Nintendo advocates, if you will, at their age level. So I have all the Nintendo consoles. I don't usually have the most modern Xbox and PlayStation, so they kind of get the Switch experience. They're a little, you know, Nintendo brainwashed, if you will. But I think that's totally okay. The games that they like to play are a really good fit for them, and you know, you can get just about any title on the Switch these days. So my approach is pretty simple as far as gaming goes. It's, you know, have fun. I set the parental controls with a time limit, and they play their time each day, and then they just balance out everything else they do. My son's in karate, my daughter's in dance. Like they do, gaming's not the only thing they do. They like to play games, but they do a lot of different things. They actually like to be outside more than they like to play games, which is kind of refreshing. They say I didn't really plan it that way, but the children love being outside and playing outside, and they enjoy playing games inside. But they're not super into like competition or high level like gaming. Yeah, they like to watch videos more than they like to play them in many cases, and that actually has been a interesting part of navigating it, because they like to watch content, but Twitch isn't really accessible to them. So you know, they get a lot of their gaming content through YouTube Kids, and if you have a YouTube Kids, to have YouTube Kids content, you have to mark your content as safe for kids, which is you know, you're basically putting it at it's limiting its money making abilities, because you have to run kids ads, and you can't have comments on your video then, and so you kind of get unique set of content that they run into. It's a lot of Minecraft, Roblox, which they love. They absolutely love that stuff. And managing how they play games that are online like that, and how they interact with other people that they don't know, it's a little bit of a scary world. You monitor it closely and just make sure that they're doing things they should be doing, and staying within their realm without being too harsh on them too. You don't want to say you're not playing that game, you don't know who you're going to talk to, you know, but just staying close as a parent to, you know, to the floor, and making sure that they're not playing too much, not engaging inappropriately, and people aren't interacting with them inappropriately, but also making sure they can have fun. There's a lot to manage there.
Yeah, no, it's there's a lot to manage there. Well said. I think you know, one of the things that I hear a lot from parents is that there's just a lot of unknowns that they, you know, they're afraid because there's so many unknowns. I feel like you have a little bit more visibility on this world. So it sounds like, you know, you're less afraid of the unknown, but more aware of making sure that they're trying to balance and some of these other aspects to try to make sure that gaming's not the only thing in their life. But are there parts of this thing that do worry you either now and or in the future?
Yeah, I'd say if you're a parent that knows nothing about gaming, it is daunting. It is scary because you don't know who your kids are talking to, and it one day if they have their own console in their own room and their own TV, and they get their own headset, then they're gonna play Call of Duty, or they're gonna play Grand Theft Auto, or they're gonna play something, and they're gonna play it online, and they're gonna chat with people because it's part of the software. Because the Nintendo stuff, you know, God bless them, but they don't offer any of that in their gaming. So yeah. The gaming that most people, you know, most generally would be worried about are the PC games, Xbox and PlayStation stuff that is, you get on the online game and you've got voice chat, text chat, whatever. You don't know who's yelling at your kid, who your kid's yelling at, who they're cursing out, who's teabagging them, right? There's a lot of unknowns there. And I think just like that, the most important thing is staying in touch with what your kid's doing and why they're doing it. If they like to play a game, why do they like to play a game? And do they have the ability to separate reality and fiction? I think that's important. Making sure they're cognizant of what they're doing. And I wouldn't say there's a certain age where kids can do that. It's definitely based on maturity level and what their experience is. So making sure they understand that breakdown is pretty important. I would say if you're looking for a breakdown of how you would get and manage that properly, how would you get in touch with your kids and manage that properly, that is, I think, the biggest key is being down to earth and understanding what they're doing and maybe doing it with them. As I've become a parent, I found that your kids really don't always care about what you're doing as long as they're doing it with you. That's
awesome.
That's more important to them than a thing. They're going to remember they did this cool thing with their dad or their mom or their parents or whoever. In my case, I had dad and mom, and in my kids' case, they've got dad and mom, but not everybody has that, right? So I understand. Whoever it is, right? Whoever your guardian figure is, they're going to remember that fondly, and make sure that they feel invested in. And video games aren't shut up, leave me alone, because that's that can be a tempting option as a parent when you have kids in your face and they're driving you crazy because they want this or that, and they're running around the house and tearing the place down. It can be a tempting, just leave me alone, go play video. I understand it. Believe me, I understand it. But it's more important that they just want to be around you. They want to spend time with you, and that's what's important to them. So making sure that you do that is, be it gaming or otherwise, I think is the most important bit.
Yeah, I totally dig that. I think that, if you got a console or a PC, it should be in a public place where you can monitor their gaming. And then the more that you can game with them, the better off it'll be, the better you will be able to set proper boundaries and, do other things to make sure that your kids feel safe. And hopefully your involvement in it will make you feel more safe about the world, and then hopefully make it more feel a little bit more safe about your kid being in the world as well. So I thought that the do it with them part is a huge part that, we always try to encourage our parents to dive into these games. And even if you're, not good or it's a struggle at first, it's a noble thing to be in there with you, because that's all the kid wants. They just want to do it with you. And I love that you brought that up.
Yeah, it's never too late to learn something new. I learned how to edit a video in 3 days. So you can do it. I promise. Anybody can learn how to do something different and take on a new game or a new challenge, even if you've never played a game before. Some people it's easier, some people it's harder, but anybody can do it.
That's awesome. That's amazing. And I think that's a good thing, high note to wrap up on. I think that you could do it, whether it's, this new career that you're trying to launch or learn a new skill or, level up. There's a lot that you could do if you just grind at it and put that work in. But Scott, can you let us know on the way out, what do you have coming up that we could keep an eye out for? And then is there a place where we should be looking and or keeping an eye, i.e. your Twitter or somewhere else?
Yeah, I'm going to be doing some commentary coming up for some events, as well as working on different projects in my background. I stream here or there, but I'd say predominantly, I've been a little quiet lately, but the place to find me is Twitter. I am there a lot. I just don't always have something to post, and that's just the nature of, I don't know if it's because I'm old or I don't, just don't always necessarily feel I need to share everything that's going on. So I just don't. But that's the best place to keep in touch with me is at the Tantalus on Twitter. And if I have something fun coming up or something cool I want to share, that's one of the first places I always post it.
Awesome. We'll make sure to post that in the show notes. So make sure to give Scott a follow on Twitter and check out everything that he's doing and, you know, just putting good vibes out into the world. So, you know, thank you so much for rapping with me. It was really cool to catch up. Looking forward to seeing you at the next Smash event, man.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. And I hope to see you there.
Understanding Esports is brought to you by Game Gym. I also want to thank my producer, Zach Soleil, and our music was created by Steven Spector. Once again, you can learn more about Game Gym and our mission at www.gamegym.com, and you can hit me up and let me know your thoughts on the podcast on Twitter at Extra Barbecue. If you like the podcast, please share it, recommend it to your friends, gamers, parents of gamers, and their pets. I'm Josh, Extra Barbecue Hafkin. This is Understanding Esports, and we'll see you next week.